So, welcome to a gorgeous day in Northeast Ohio. I feel bad for you being here. There aren't going to be too many of these days left. But thanks for being here. And Webbies, I hope you're enjoying the day if you aren't here. Lecture 16, October 24th. Lecture notes, page 134. And happy Diwali to anyone who celebrates Diwali. So, happy Diwali. Little advertisement for some upcoming courses. If you'd like to spend some time in Greece on us, there's a summer course, Marketing 45-189, Exploring Sustainability through Sales and Marketing Perspective in Greece. Our last group of students to go there, exploring Athens, delicious food, historical sites in Crete and Santorini, and a variety of business tours. And just think, you can be there. So if you're looking for a little short term, because it runs May 18th to June 7th, international experience, write that one down. Also, if you find digital to be intriguing, we have a new offering for spring 2023 with one of our new-to-us professors, Dr. Chris Mayer. He does digital marketing. And so that's Marketing 45095. In this course, you're going to be able to actually earn 5 in-demand industry certificates, Google Analytics, Google Ads, HubSpot Email Marketing, HubSpot Inbound Marketing, participate in a digital marketing simulation, and learn about digital user experience, customer relationship management, and digital ad creation. I may have to sign up for that course. And so again, that's Marketing 45095 for the spring. If it interests you, I'll probably leave it up for a couple of housekeeping cycles. Mini-test 7, as you know, closed on Saturday, the usual timing, 88% average, 93% of the students participating. It's closed, and Mini-test 8, on the usual schedule, open on Tuesday. Enhanced learning, extra credit, and pack back number 5. We skipped a week because of fall break, so it is running through Wednesday the 26th. That's next one, this coming Wednesday. On to business in the news. So how many of you guys know Albertsons? Is that a grocery store we know? Albertsons? Not really? We all know Kroger's, though, yeah? You know Albertsons, too. We know Kroger's, right? Yeah. So Kroger's is planning to buy Albertsons. I just love how we throw around billions of dollar deals. $24.6 billion deal that would create a new grocery giant. Kroger said it's buying rival Albertsons in a deal that values the company at $24.6 billion, one of the biggest deals in the history of the U.S. grocery industry. So here we're seeing a corporate growth strategy. We often are talking about that, in this case through acquisition. Combining would give Kroger and Albertsons, the largest and second largest U.S. supermarket operators, greater scale and increased leverage in negotiations with vendors. So here's some of the advantages of corporate size in the marketplace. For Kroger, Albertsons bring a complementary footprint with stores in parts of the country where Kroger has none. The deal will lead to faster and more profitable growth. Together, the companies said their stores would supply groceries for an estimated 85 million households. That's a pretty good segment of the population. Analysts said the deal could face a rigorous regulatory review, with federal antitrust enforcers having challenged some mergers under the Biden administration. I pause to say here, when we talked about the crest factors, including regulatory, legal, and political factors, right, which is what this is, we also commented as a business person, you had to keep an eye on what the current administration was doing about this sort of topic. Sometimes it's a hot button, sometimes they don't mess much with it, and you have to project what the current administration is going to do vis-a-vis your particular business choices. So Kroger and Albertsons, which both operate stores in places including Southern California, Washington, Texas, and Washington, D.C., said they expect to sell overlapping stores as a part of the deal to help win regulatory approval. So they'd be selling off to competitors, arguably, so they wouldn't have as much market share. So there's the impact of crest factors on business. Together, Kroger's and Albertsons would command about 13% of the food retail sales in the U.S. following divestitures for regulatory approval. So that's actually smaller than a big competitor. Walmart's really big in the food industry. They have 22% of the food retail sales in the U.S. So here's competition in the marketplace. Combined, the company said they would have a bigger network of stores, distributors, and suppliers in addition to a national reach and greater manufacturing footprint. integrating their supply chains, which shorten the time it takes products to hit the stores, executives said. Pulling customer data would help the companies engage better with shoppers, such as offering personalized promotions. So we see the issue of supply chains in this decision, channels of distributions being modified, and of course the importance of data to business and dealing with consumers. Grocers are generally have performed well in recent years, benefiting as consumers directed more of their food purchasing towards supermarkets during the pandemic. Companies have raised prices over the past year in response to what executives have said are rapidly increasing costs, and consumers are still spending on essentials even as they are pulling back on spending elsewhere. Kroger and Albertsons have said consumers are trading down as prices rise, buying lower cost store brands or items on sale. So here we're seeing the impact of the pandemic and the impact of inflation on business and consumers. So if you are selling a national brand, you have to watch to see what's happening in the most recent times to the private labels that are now. People are switching over to the store brands instead of the national brands. More than a crunch, how a 1.5-second tune, a sonic brand, changed the Tostitos brand. With consumers increasingly taking to audio content like podcasts, Tostitos has developed a sonic brand in an attempt to cut through the noise. In the years since debuting the concept, the Frito-Lay label has seen dramatic success and now plans to expand that sonic brand play onto platforms like TikTok. So adapting our promotion to changing consumer behavior, people moving more to audio than they have been. The strategy formed around an easing in the pandemic restrictions that caused Tostitos' target audience, the at-home gatherers and late-night snackers. How many of you guys like Tostitos? Tostitos? Not many fans. To return to dining out. At the same time, the brand found evidence that consumers go for their dip first and the carrier of the dip or chip second. So research to understand consumers' behavior at work. Time spent streaming audio is up 32% year over year, and 67 million U.S. consumers listen to podcasts each month. Ads with sonic branding elements see an uplift in the attention paid to that ad by 8.5 times those that don't use a sonic brand. But above all, audio has the potential to drive brand recognition due to its ability to follow consumers regardless of where they are. So we're using it to get customers' attention and brand recognition. Let's see hear what they have to say about this sonic brand idea and how they developed it, what their thinking was.
The new sonic identity for Tostitos. Here's a scoop. Our fans are constantly seeking connections. They're social instigators, always inspiring us to get to the good stuff. And we know they're spending more time on audio channels, where they actually can't see our branding. Tostitos stands for togetherness. We needed a distinct sonic signature that was ownable, timeless, social, and fun. And to create the sound of togetherness, we thought, what if a group of friends got together and actually made music with our products? Like our delicious crunch, our exciting jar pop. Then we discovered something unexpected. Our salsa jars are in tune? Whoa! Better still, our new sound is measurably proven to increase ad recall, brand appeal, and fun. And clocking in at 1.5 seconds, this may be the fastest sonic logo on the planet. Impactful and flexible in every sound-on environment. Going beyond the bowl, the soundtrack for social instigators. The new sonic identity for Tostitos. Get to the good stuff.
So as we'll see in a minute, if they had used something like the crunch sound from a Tostitos, how's that different than the crunch sound from any other chip? Even the jar opening would be a common sound, but this thing of their particular jar is being tapped on, they thought was unique. So the end product needed to be more than a crunching sound. The creative team said as that would be a difficult asset to own in the snacking category. To illustrate the point, they noted that there are 12 to 15 brands that use the simple sound of a ringing doorbell as their sonic branding, which leads to a lack of differentiation. People don't know what it refers to. So they're trying to get the message right. To be more authentic, Tostitos sound entailed opening a lot of the brands, jarge, queso, guacamole, and salsa, to capture the perfect pop. The sound was created entirely by using Tostitos products. The final tune, as we just heard, runs a short 1.5 seconds, designed to allow as much content as possible in front of the sound in its advertisements while still relating back to the brand, with key tip-offs like the popping open of its own jars and biting into a chip as the lead-in to the sound. Before deploying the Sonic brand at scale, they test-marketed it to see how it would perform. If you recall back to research, we talked a little bit about test marketing. It met their expectations quickly. Research conducted 6 months after the release found a significant increase in consumer sentiment about the brand, their liking for the brand. Most importantly, there was a 38% increase in brand recall stemming from the audio addition. So brand markets where they had it recalled it 38% more people recalled it than they did in markets where they didn't have the sound, so test marketing the promotion. And it's the sort of thing that Gen Z might pick up on and use in their social media posts. We'll see if it becomes popular that way. How many people know Youngblood? Is that a rocker we know? Oh, more people know Youngblood than like Tostitos. Okay, whatever. So Youngblood chewed, this is hysterical to me, Youngblood's chewed gum becomes a treasure in a five gum partnership. Chewing gum has a pretty limited use. You unwrap it, you chew it, you spit it out, and you throw it away. Well, except if you're MacGyver, who's been known to fix a blown fuse with a gum wrapper. British rocker Youngblood and sugar-free five gum have found a new use for spent chewing gum: jewelry. My wife gagged a little bit when I told her this, marking the news story. It doesn't seem to be a gag. The star partnered up with the Mars Wrigley brand and a jeweler, Greg Yuna, to create a line of ice using Youngblood's own saliva-filled gum, titled, of course, Masterpieces. So we're getting attention. We're using celebrities in marketing. We have brand partnerships here. 15 of those chewed-up pieces of cobalt peppermint 5 gum were sent to Yuna and transferred into necklaces. No two necklaces are alike. Each one contains a piece of blue gum in its original chewed shape, encased in lucite. The pendant is encrusted with white diamonds and features a charm engraved with the 5 gum logo and Yuna's signature stamp. The chain is 14 karat white gold. The necklaces will come in a custom designed 5 gum jewelry box featuring an exterior inscription noting the edition number. How many people think they'd like to have a piece of that gum from Youngblood? Don't all raise your hands at once. How much would you pay for such a pendant? Think about that. Okay. They'd have to pay you to take it. Let's see what happens in the real world, though. As the brand that strives to be the most adventurous and distinct brand for life's most exhilarating moments, Five Gum's partnership with two authentically bold artistic geniuses like Youngblood and Greg Yuna was a natural fit and a great honor. So we're seeing the brand image here. Knowing Gen Z is a generation of barrier-breaking, thrill-seeking change-makers and future leaders, we wanted to partner with an artist who's authentic to this group and their beliefs, dreams, and accomplishments, and makes their voices heard through their art, appealing to that target market. The teenage-leaning brand of Mars Wrigley 5 Gum has marketed to young people with campaigns like its 2018 warning about their regrets through the eyes of the elderly. Youngblood was dubbed the voice of youthful disenchantment at his debut in the same year, with much of his audience overlapping with the consumer's 5 Gum that the 5 Gum brand is interested in reaching. Proceeds from the sale of the jewelry will go to the National Independent Venue Foundation, so it's a charitable effort, but certainly getting involvement and attention. Gum aficionados can bid on the necklaces now through October 26th on eBay. Now, this click worked in the office and home. Let's see if it works here, because it is amusing to see what people will pay for it. So there he is. There's the gum. I'm going to scroll down. Let's see what people are willing to pay for it on a bid. $560, $510, $355. $540, $560, $630, $490, $375, $340, $380, $376. So why is that particular piece look better to people than any other? I have no idea. And obviously people know also they're helping the charity. But really, not negative $150, but to them, $630. So it's obviously getting some interest, getting consumers involved in the brand, helping charity too. But I'm pretty sure it's good for all the brands involved. Don't worry, my wife isn't participating either. So, all right, so that is an interesting little marketing in the news, getting consumers' attention, appealing to the target audience. So we pick up the lecture notes, page 134 and page 256 in the textbook. As we're talking about, continue to talk about STP, brand segmentation, target marketing, and positioning. And we just had finished up thinking about Victoria's Secret. How many of you guys have heard the song Victoria's Secret? Yeah, I decided not to play that. It sounded, even that sounded too creepy for me, an old man somewhere. Never mind. So if you are thinking about segmentation, you have to think about where you're going to fit your image in the minds of the consumer against competition. So what you would need to do is find out what are the important attributes that consumers look for in your brand, okay? So in this case, research has shown that for these fashion houses, for these clothing stores, the two relevant dimensions are fashion-forward versus traditional and limited service versus extensive service, all right? So those are the two dimensions that consumers seem to feel are important. Then what they do is position the competition on the map. Where would you not especially think there's a good opportunity for a new brand to come in? What area? So what? The area with a whole bunch of people. So I think it's probably a bad idea to say my new brand ought to go up where Neiman Marcus, Saks Fifth Avenue, Bloomingburg's, and Nordstrom's are, right? That seems like an odd choice to make. But there are other areas out there where you might begin to look. There are a couple unoccupied positions, which may or may not be practical, but it's worth looking at, yeah? And so you might say, with your target audience in mind, you want to select a positioning concept that's valuable to them, that differentiates you from the competition. So could you be, are there consumers who want fashion forward with less service? Or somewhat traditional with moderate service? Those are unoccupied spaces according to our analysis. Is this a market where you could work? Then design the dimensions or the features that most effectively convey this position to your target audience, whichever one you chose. So communicate that out with your brand name or with the store features or with the website, whatever it would be that makes sense to you to get this idea out. And then coordinate your marketing mix components to convey a consistent position. All of the marketing elements should complement this intended position, segmentation, targeting, positioning, building this image of the mind of the consumer, whatever it is. So often a perceptual map will help us to think about this positioning approach. And of course, that assumes that you met the segmentation criteria that we talked about a lecture or two ago. So what are some mistakes you can make in doing your positioning? Well, one issue is not doing a very good job of building that image in the mind of the consumer, under-positioning, failing to position the brand very well. What was this idea of Crystal Pepsi, a clear soda product that tastes like Pepsi? What is it supposed to be? Is it supposed to be like an uncola, like ginger? What is it supposed to be? They didn't make it sell. Didn't make any sense. Although KFC has swapped back and forth, they wanted to be known as KFC for a while. But, of course, what did that stand for initially? Kentucky Fried Chicken. Pretty clear positioning there, what you are, yeah? Now we're KFC, and we lost for a while the Colonel. What are you again? You used to be fried chicken. Now you're KFC with no Colonel. More recently, of course, they brought the Colonel back in a variety of different incarnations to try to reposition what the brand is in the minds of the consumer. Say, so, well, yeah, KFC, good chicken. Or you can over-position, creating too narrow a picture in the minds of the consumer. How many of you guys either like getting, like buying, like giving, like receiving jewelry? Is that a thing people still like these days? One person, two people, three people. So I don't know what people do this day. Webbies, you like to get jewelry? If you like to give or get jewelry, how often does it occur to you think of Tiffany's? You think about Tiffany's because you'd like to get it or because you want to buy it? Or just because you think of Tiffany's? Tiffany's might cost like too much, which is the image they build, right? The image that they have in the mind of the consumer. But in fact, of course, depending how much money you have to spend or how much you want to spend, There are some things that don't cost thousands of dollars that you might be able to consider. Show me some prices here, my friends. I don't know, let's go here. We have some prices. So here is the New York Tiffany's at $250. I mean, it's not nothing, but it's also not a several thousand dollar purchase. What's this one at? A little more expensive, $400. What did I actually want to find? Jewelry in general? I guess that's where we are. They've changed their work. There's what we usually think of as Tiffany's, yeah. $11,000, $9,000. But hey, a couple hundred for a special occasion might be, no thanks, might be something that we might think about being able to do. So they, in fact, limit themselves by positioning themselves as being so very expensive, when in fact we can get things for a little less expensive, a couple hundred bucks if we want. So maybe it's over-positioning. Or confused positioning. This is when we claim two or more contradictory benefits, or we keep changing our positions. And again, it leaves buyers with a confused image of a product. How many people know the brand Velveeta? And what is it? It's a
cookie.
Is it what? Cookies? No. It's what?
It's a cheese,
but for a long time, people couldn't quite figure out, what do I use this cheese? Is it supposed to be snacking? Is it supposed to be cooking? How should I use Velveeta against other choices I have out there? And so in order to clear things up, a while ago, they came up with some special uses for Velveeta in holiday cooking to help people picture what the thing might be in their mind. Yeah? People are confused about what it is. So what are some basic positioning platforms you might choose for your brand, given your target audience and what you're all about? You could go with the idea of a premium positioning or a status symbol positioning. So when we think expensive cars, expensive sports cars maybe, we might think about Maserati. We aren't really thinking about an inexpensive brand when we think Maserati, yeah? Do you guys know Stuart Hughes as a designer? Do we know Stuart Hughes? So Stuart Hughes specializes in ridiculously expensive toys for the very rich. So here is a diamond BlackBerry. Why anybody wants a BlackBerry these days for 15,000 pounds? Here's a Nokia Crown for 15,000 pounds. Here's a cheap 24-gal golden platinum iPhone 11 Pro Edition for 7,000 pounds. If you're into gaming, how about a nice Nintendo Wii Supreme for only 300,000 pounds? Obvious, yes, ma'am. I don't know what it is in American dollars right now. They're about, actually, unusually, they're about the same. So it's about 300 American dollars, yeah. And usually when the exchange rate is worse for the dollars, that would be $400,000. So people actually do buy that product. Not you and I, but it's a particular niche, a particular segment, a particular positioning as premium or status symbol. On the flip side, if you aren't buying a Maserati, maybe you're going to position your brand as a good value for the money. Here's the best subcompact cars for 2022 and 2023. Nothing will be near the cost of a Maserati. So here we're in the $17,000 range, $23,000, etc. So there's a different way to think about positioning your brand. How about friendly, family values, warmth? Bash's grocery store, your hometown grocery store, a family-owned and operated grocery that began back in 1932. We've changed over the years, and including development, but we strive to grow and improve our business with a continued focus on the needs of our customers. We maintain commitment to the betterment of our community through service and support, etc. And so that might be your approach. IBM for a long time was hardware by our equipment. They've switched their attitude and their marketing to a softer side, to providing business solutions. See how CEOs are embracing sustainability to a better environment in the bottom line, and think about how IBM can help solve that problem. What do you think, Disney? Among other things, what might you think of? Fun, as well as a little expensive. And so Disney's out there with that positioning. trendy and stylish, Oster, De Laurentiis, and Zara. Or role model, user image, reliability, trust, quality, premium, celebrity endorsements, anti-establishment or rebel, a technology leader and innovator, service leader. And of course, you can combine various positioning strategies together. So when you think Disney, although I put it out under fun, you probably would also think family. So how about family fun? So you can start making more complex positioning decisions for your target audience and what they value and what differentiates you from the competition. So lots of different ways to do that. So STP, segmentation, dividing up the mass market into groups that have different needs and wants and desires from one another. Targeting, selecting one or more of those to focus your marketing efforts on. Positioning, building that brand image in the mind of the consumer that differentiates you from the competition and causes them to want you over somebody else. STP, yeah? All right, with this in mind, we talk about the marketing mix and building products and services that are going to appeal to that segment of the population. So let's think a little bit about one of the P's of the marketing mix, the first one we're going to talk about, which is the idea of developing new products and services. Lecture notes, page 138, chapter 10 in the textbook. And the first of the four P's we're going to think about. Remember, we started the course at the 30,000-foot level above what you do every day. We drifted down a little bit. Now we're getting towards the 10,000-foot level, again, over your everyday job. We're developing the four P's of the marketing mix against all this background we've talked about previously, starting with the idea of products or services and viewed a different way. Here we show it as the circle, product, place, price, promotion, the four P's of the marketing mix, an integrated plan of action with the consumer at the center, B2B or B2C, and we start with product, broadly speaking, including services marketing. So one question is, why do we start with the idea of new products? Who needs them? I go back in ancient history to make the points that everybody doesn't quite get them. Tom Watson, the chairman of IBM in 1943, said, I think there's a world market for maybe five computers. He didn't have much of a vision, but in those days, computers were room size, required special heating, special electric, and they didn't do much. But he was wrong about the future of computers. Thomas Edison said, you know that thing we created, the radio craze? That'll die out very quickly. Obviously, radio is still around in a somewhat different format, perhaps streaming rather than an old box, but still. Ken Olson, chairman and founder of Digital Equipment, DEC, said there's no reason anybody would want a computer in their home, again, right at the time, but that's 1977, he's saying that, right before computers became small enough to get in an office and then in a home. Daryl Zenick, talking about television, says video, television, won't be around more than 6 months. People soon get tired of staring at a plywood box. So these are old examples of significant players getting the future of the product wrong. So it's hard to foresee what happens with new products. Yeah, it's hard to see the future for innovations. But let's think about a more recent event of creating new products. Anybody here ride a bike? This kind of bike? We have a single person ride a motorcycle. Oh, thank you. What do you ride? Suzuki. Okay, as you get older, married, and bones break, and kids are around, you ride a little less, but my Honda Nighthawk is sitting in the garage. So, new products. Who needs them? Harley Davidson, if you've heard of the brand, was an if you build it, they'll come kind of company, focused on the product, right? For most of its 110-year history, Harley sold as many motorcycles as it could make to customers who knew the brand well. They were older, they were affluent white men. But the recent recession really brought them into the 21st century as sales and profits dropped. The 2014 models featured a voice-activated and touchscreen GPS system, the first on a production motorcycle. When the bike is getting low on fuel, the system finds the nearest filling station and maps out directions to it on a 6.5-inch screen that the rider can control by voice, touch, or joystick. Please do not use a joystick to control your screen while riding down the highway at 85 miles an hour. Thank you. For the first time, the company used customer focus groups and dealer clinics to develop new models and features. They actually talked to the customers. The loss of sales during the recession prompted the company to cut costs speed development of new products and features, and seek more advice on how to put new customers onto new bikes. The new touring line of motorcycles, some of Hardy's priciest and most profitable, start at $18,000 for the Road King, $26,000 for the Ultra Limited, and can cost more than $40,000. The line appeals to Harley's traditional customers as well as its new buyers, women, younger drivers, African Americans, and customers outside the U.S. The thing that really drove this project was the customer service, said Bill Davidson, who runs Harley's Milwaukee Museum. In the past, we'd go out and maybe hand-select a few customers or dealers, but this was more sophisticated, more global, much more thorough research, doing marketing research to understand the consumer. In 2015, buyers outside the U.S. accounted for 39% of Harley sales. More than half of its dealerships are outside the U.S. as the company tries to broaden its traditional customer base. It can be quite a status symbol and somewhat hard to get. The guy who used to run our facility in Geneva, Switzerland, was rabid to try to get his hands on a Harley-Davidson. After years of coveting it, he finally got one. And I had a student that went over who was a Harley-Davidson fan and couldn't wait to get to the local store to get a Harley-Davidson Geneva sweat T-shirt. A lot of things going on in Geneva other than Harley-Davidson's store, but that was her big desire. Moving forward to 2020, the results are not as good as hoped for. Not everything works out. In 2017, the median age of Harley riders in the U.S. was 52. Rather than ginning up fresh interest among 20-somethings, Harley is now hinting that it's narrowing its aim towards the affluent professionals who can afford its pricey bikes. We're sharpening our focus on products and customers who are riding Harley-Davidson motorcycles who already have interest. Johann Zietz, the 2020 CEO with a strong marketing background, sees electrification in a model called LiveWire as one solution to the brand's demographic challenge. How do we get people interested? Let's electrify our bikes. So, Harley-Davidson focuses on consumers and trying to come up with new products to satisfy that new audience. So we would say that great ideas are the cornerstone of business success. For example, PricewaterhouseCoopers says 50% or more of plausible business ideas for new products come from customers, competitors, and suppliers. Well, that seems like everybody. Where's the other 50% come from, according to their research? The company's employees. But the challenge is always, how do you get your customer employees to respond? You have a little suggestion box where people write stuff down and stuff it? I mean, how's that work? So today, of course, the challenge is, how do we stimulate employees to make suggestions, and how can we sort through the various suggestions to find promising ideas, given who we are, what we are, what's practical, etc.? Well, of course, these days, there is a software solution for that. So Imaginatic Innovative Central, now called PlanBox, is an online, if you will, suggestion system. To create a culture of innovation, organizations need creative, collaborative work environments. IT has a key role to play here. A new generation of enterprise resource planning, ERP systems, for example, takes advantage of cloud computing, mobile computing, social business tools, and big data analytics to allow everybody in the company to come together and make contributions towards new ideas, improvements, and they set up a whole thing on how to create and influence positive outcomes from those employees. So why not take advantage of 50% of the new product ideas coming internally? How many of you guys, any Lego fans here? Anybody still like Legos? One, two, oh, we've got some Lego fans over there. More people like Legos than they like Tostitos. Maybe we made Lego Tostitos. I'll get back to that idea. So they actually have a way to crowdsource new products. So let's take a look at how Legos handles new ideas.
Have you ever had an idea for a new Lego set? On Lego Ideas, you can check out proposals for new Lego sets created by fans just like you. Find your favorite projects, vote, give feedback, and even submit your own. If a project gets 10,000 votes, it enters the Lego review phase. Then, our review board evaluates and selects which project will become the next LEGO Ideas product. Members whose projects are selected are recognized for inspiring a LEGO Ideas set. and even receive a percentage of the product's sales. Once the design process is complete, the next LEGO Ideas product is produced in our factory and shipped to stores. Finally, the LEGO Ideas product is available to buy. And you made it happen on LEGO Ideas. So what are you waiting for? Check out cool projects on the Discover page, or learn how to submit your own by clicking How It Works. The next set we approve might even be yours.
What a cool, crazy way to get your fan base involved and crowdsource ideas for new products, including the possibility that you earn money from your new product idea on their website. I assume this is still active for us. So here I am at ideaslego.com/all, and here are some new ideas coming out. Here's how to submit an idea. Yes, yes. Here's a new idea called Bambi. Here's a motorized lighthouse. And here's some scary builds where you can enter your activities for a scary Legos build for Halloween, I presume. So if you're really a fan, here's your opportunity to get a new product out there and, hey, maybe pick up some bucks along the way. So that's an interesting way to think about new products. So returning to basics, just to make sure we're all on the same page, what is a product that we're creating a new one of? Well, a product is a set of tangible and intangible attributes. I threw out these words and it's not always clear. People know what I mean. So what's a tangible attribute of a product? Tangible attribute. Something that you can taste, touch, feel, whatever's left here, smell, is a tangible attribute of the product. So what would an intangible attribute of a product be? Well, yes, something you can't do that, but give me an example. Yeah?
Like an idea.
Like an idea. The thing is fun. Can't touch fun, but a product might claim to be fun, right? So what are the intangible things that make up your product? Something emotional. When we say product, we mean it generally. It can be a good. It can be a service. It can be a place. It can be a person. It can be an idea. And if you remember back to the first or second class that we talked about, we actually gave examples of all those things being marketed. Maybelline, mascara, online video things, the Texas example for place. Person, of course, were political candidates. And the ideas were don't drive and text because you're going to get yourself into trouble. So these things, the sort of tangible and intangible attributes, provide satisfaction of a consumer's need, want, or desire, and they do that in the form of benefits. So what are we trying to do? Let's backtrack to the basics. Discover and satisfy consumers' needs, wants, and desires at a profit to renew great effort of the firm, providing value to them. So we need to provide satisfaction of the needs, wants, and desires in the form of benefits using our product, whether it's a good service, place, person, or idea. And of course, since profit is part of the story, this thing is exchanged for money in most cases, or some other unit of value, your time, if it is perhaps a charitable organization. And the total product is a bundle of those tangible and intangible benefits that you put together to provide benefit for the consumer. At the core, we have the basic benefits of the product. They're the fundamental needs that the customer satisfies when they buy the product. Why do you buy toothpaste at the core? Let's see if we get anybody else, somebody else participating. Why do you buy toothpaste? If you aren't sure, then maybe we shouldn't have you buy toothpaste. Why? To clean your teeth, yeah? Could you imagine buying a toothpaste that didn't clean your teeth? It wouldn't really be a toothpaste. So at its core is the basic thing the thing does. Toothpaste cleans teeth. Yay! It also is not very differentiating, though. But your core product has to provide that basic need that we're talking about. So at its core, a product like toothpaste certainly has to clean teeth. There are other core things we want it to do. So we want it to maybe prevent tooth decay, pretty core. cleans your teeth but doesn't help you with tooth decay. Whitens your teeth, a pretty core idea. Okay? So these might be some of the basic features or benefits that are core to the product, without which you can't very well compete in that field. So products are rarely marketed using the core product because everybody has to have the core product to be in the business. They seldom... Yeah, you're actually at this point annoying me. And now I gotta do this. I don't know what kind of show we're doing. I'm sure it's highly amusing. I know it's been going on for weeks, but you gotta maybe focus up here, or at least not be so entertaining that these guys are high-fiving you and laughing, because then I'm gonna ask you to shut it up, put it away, or leave. That's okay, but it's been going on for a long time. So you'll do that now, right? Because the core product offers no competitive advantage. Everybody has to do that thing. Would you buy a toothpaste that didn't provide white teeth, prevent tooth decay, or provide righted teeth? I don't think so, right? So you have to understand the core, so you're providing the basics. But then you're going to get to the actual product, including the physical good itself, the brand name, and all those other things that make you special. So are you perceived as a premium brand? Are you perceived as a budget brand? Those things are forming part of the actual product. So here is Crest Pro Advanced, Pro Health Advanced. So the brand name is Crest Pro Health. That's part of the product, and whatever Crest means to you, freshens breath, has a particular flavor. Anybody ever get a toothpaste where when they tasted it, they went, ugh, didn't like it? Yeah, my wife went to, I forget what she brought home, but I went to brush my teeth, and was like, ugh. What is that? So the particular flavor can be important sort of thing. Whitening, this one also, though, provides protection from gingivitis, plaque, tartar. It also works on sensitivity, enamel erosion, creates healthier gums and stronger teeth. Well, you can see it goes beyond just the basics. So what are we providing as benefits? We've got social confidence. We've got taste good. We've got more social confidence. We've got lower dental bills. And so... the whole thing builds together to be more than just a basic toothpaste. And then we carry that forth, of course, with our advertisements for the product.
To be honest, I thought a lot of toothpastes were pretty much the same. But then my husband started getting better dental checkups than me. So I did what he did. I went pro with Crest Pro Health Advanced.
Advanced to healthier gums and stronger teeth from day one.
My mouth is getting healthier. My teeth are getting stronger.
Crest Pro Health Advanced gives you a healthier mouth and is superior in these five key areas.
This is going to go well. I know it.
Advance to healthier gums and stronger teeth from day one.
I guess all toothpastes aren't the same.
Ha ha! They aren't all the same. How about that fun? So what is it that you're going to do with your product to provide a unique selling proposition? So in addition to all this, the total product also has auxiliary dimensions or supplementary benefits that include the intangible features like the warranty, the customer service, and these augmented product features can be important ways to tailor a product to meet the needs of specific customers. My brand of toothpaste might provide a number for Poison Control Central, whatever that is. Why would anyone care about Poison Control Central for a toothpaste? Why might that be something that some of my target audience might care about? Yeah. You have a little kid. You walk into the bathroom, little kid's sucking down the tube of toothpaste. Should you be concerned or not? Should you call? I got you covered. You probably don't have to worry about it, but still, call my number because I care about you and your kids. Right? So what's important to your consumer, to your product? So here's some of the augmented product is the ADA Seal of Acceptance, a 1-800 customer service number, and the fact that 4 out of 5 dentists recommend this product, if those are all cases. So you have the core, we have the augmented product as well. In your company, you may have only one product. You're a pretty small company, so your product line is that company. But in a lot of cases, we have more than one product line. So a product line is a group of closely related products that, for example, satisfy a certain class of needs, gardening, household cleaning, car washing, that are used together Cosmetics. So you might use lipstick and mascara and eyeliner that are sold to the same customer group, that are distributed through the same type of outlet, or that fall within a given price range. What makes sense for you depends on what your products are, who your target audience is, how they work together. But this is the idea of a group of a product line satisfying one of these things. For example, Church & Dwight, we recognize the symbol up there, right? What's that symbol? What's the brand that comes to mind? Arm & Hammer, but actually Church & Dwight is the company. And they have a series of product lines out there. For example, in the area of personal care, they have antiperspirants and deodorants, and eye care products, and fertility products, and hair removal, Nair for women and Nair for men, nasal care, Simply Saline, a neti pot, oral care products, including Arm & Hammer, Spin, Brutchian, Close-Up, Minident, and Pepsodent, ovulation measurement, First Response Daily Ovulation Test, and their wound wash, Simply Saline. So that is their personal care line of products, okay? However, the company also has household products. For example, they have Arm & Hammer baking soda, which perhaps you've heard of. They also have Arm & Hammer deodorization products, fridge and freezer, fabric care products, OxiClean Extra, Arm & Hammer detergent, household cleaners in general, pet care products, wood care products. And so they have a couple of product lines out there, okay? And they may have more, but that's the point, that you can see these are somewhat different than those, household versus personal care, yeah? So you market them different, they might go to a different target audience. The product mix refers to the number of product lines that your company offers. The width of your product mix refers to the number of product lines carried, so Church & Dwight is pretty broad in terms of the number of product lines that they carry. Spider Paintball, which we talked about last time, much narrower product mix, all focused on paintball, paintball accessories, paintball clothing. So how wide is your product mix? Letting you think about how complicated it's going to be to market it. The depth of the product mix refers to the average number of products in each of the lines that you carry. How many flavors, sizes, shapes are there of the thing? And how consistent is your product mix? Does everything fit together, or is it sort of all over the place? Spider, pretty consistent. Church & Dwight, not so consistent. So here's an example in a retail environment. Do you guys know Redken, the Redken brand? Yeah. Redken. So here's Redken is fairly narrow, focused on hair care products, but also pretty deep. So they have hair coloring. Yeah, well, others do too, but they've got hair coloring, coral, rose, pink, purple, etc. Hair care, they have oil, shampoo, mask, spray, conditioner. Hair styling, they have hairspray, lotion, holding spray, wax. So they have a fairly narrow set of product lines, hair, but a lot of choices within, and there's a retail display for Redken. Let's think now what we would get at CVS by comparison, which also carries some of these products, right? Well, does CVS carry hair products? Well, sure, but it's part of a line of beauty products in general. So there's their hair care. But they also carry vitamins and dietary and grocery products, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they have a very wide product line. And their depth within each product line is probably not as deep in each line as we see here for Redken. So what's your strategy? And what does it mean for your marketing mix? At a broad level, we can classify products into B2C, consumer goods, products that are purchased by you, the ultimate consumer. We spent a lot of time thinking about that. And we think about, eventually we'll get to B2B, but in consumer goods themselves, we can think about them based on their durability or tangibility. So on the one hand, we have a product which is a pure good, a physical product, and the good itself is tangible, durable. You can taste it, touch it, feel it. So if I ask you to go out and get me a good shovel at your next trip at Ace Hardware, could you probably do that? You probably could. And how would you know it was a good shovel, ignoring price? You might pick it up. You might feel, is it heavy? You might bang it on the ground, although they may ask you why you're banging a shovel, to see how solid it is. You might jiggle the handle. Check the blade. It's a good shovel. Thank you for getting the shovel for me, okay? In the middle ground, we have things that have some goods with some service component. And so we have a restaurant. The good, of course, is the food. The service is, of course, the service. Have you ever had a situation where you recommended a restaurant to somebody because you went and it was really good, good service, and you went the next time, and it wasn't good service? It happens, right? Why? Because it's not as tangible. The shovel is still the shovel. The restaurant and its service and its food is variable. Who knows? And finally, we have the idea out here of a pure service. Anybody going to get a haircut in the next week or so? Yeah? Let's pretend you are. Can you go get one for me, please? Well, no, don't be stupid. Why? It's a service. It's not physical. It's not a tangible good. So we have these different levels of tangibility from a pure good, purely physical, and a pure service, something that is purely intangible. Employment service. How do you tell walking in if it's really a solid, good employment service product? I don't know. It's not like a shovel. How can I tell? I got to sort of guess. All right? So we think about consumer goods based on durability, based on tangibility from goods to services. We also can think about classifying consumer goods based on how interested, involved, intrigued the consumer is by the particular product category. How much effort are your consumers willing to spend for your product? So we talk about products that are convenience products for consumers, shopping products for consumers, and specialty products for consumers. A convenience good is one that's purchased frequently, conveniently, with a minimum of shopping effort. Can you think of anything that you buy regularly and you don't put too much effort or thought into? Yeah. Say again. Toothpaste? We're back to toothpaste example, yeah. Milk? How many people buy milk? How many people spend a lot of time thinking about which milk they're going to buy and where they're going to go and which size they're going to buy? One person, most people don't. It's a convenience product, right? Magazines, snack food, gasoline, milk, toothpaste, for many people is a convenience product. Shopping products. These are products where consumers compare several alternatives on some important criteria to them, such as price or quality or style. You might do this for computers. Put a little effort into it, right? Furniture, choosing a fitness center. You have some things you want in mind, including price. You're going to compare a few things before you decide. A little more effort. Might you need to provide more information on a website for computers than you would for milk? Yeah, consumers are just willing to spend more effort. And then a specialty product. This is a product that a consumer is really involved in, is really important to them. They want to make the right choice. They're going to make a special effort to search out and buy the right one. Luxury cars, a tax attorney, designer clothes, wedding gowns. How many, was it, what's the wedding gown TV show called? Which is it? Say yes to the dress. Now, that's, of course, far on the continuum, but there are people there that are going crazy over, right, picking the right dress. It's really important. They're not going for convenience, right? For them, it's really critically important. What would that mean for your marketing mix, for your sales force training, for your retail environment, for your website? What are your consumers, how involved are your consumers in the product? So, convenience products, characteristics, relatively inexpensive, purchases regular and reoccurring. We don't think a lot about it. Minimal shopping effort. We usually are going to buy it within the store in the most convenient location. So, staple products like groceries and maybe impulse purchases. Candy bars. Where in grocery stores do we often see the candy bar? At the cashier. Well, candy aisle, but also at the cashier aisle. We're standing around. We're waiting. It's at eye level, so if you have kids in the cart, they can see it too. And you make a... You know, anybody ever make that impulse purchase right there on the thing for a magazine or a candy bar? I'm just, oh, look at that. Twix. Yay. All right. So what's this mean from a strategy viewpoint? Well, you want to make it available everywhere you can. Why? Because people are not going to look all around for this product. They don't care that much. How far are you willing to search for milk? How many stores are you willing to go to? One. Make it visible inside the store. People aren't going to search all over the store for it. Distribution, then, is a major factor in the marketing mix, getting it out there to all those stores. It's easy substitution by some other brand. Consumers will accept another brand. I might have a preference for 2% milk of one brand, but it's pretty much the same as 2% brand of another brand. And oftentimes for this product category, toothpaste, say, extensive advertising is used to make sure consumers think of us. Trident chewing gum, it might be an example. Shopping products, we're willing to put some effort into. So these things happen when product comparisons do occur. Consumers do want some information, so you have to be aware of that, provided to them. Decisions are based more on thought than just impulse purchases. Has anybody ever had to go buy like an apartment microwave oven? Yeah? So you didn't just go out and buy the first one on the shelf, I presume. You put a little thought into it. Okay, what are they? What do they cost? What do they do? It's often technology or fashion-oriented. There are monetary risks and social risks. And in some cases, brand loyal may be found, either to the store. I really like my electronics from Best Buy or Home Depot, or I really like the GE brand. All right, strategy then. You don't have to be in every possible outlet because people will seek you out a little bit. They're involved. Consumers will seek the product in less visible locations in the store because they really want that microwave. Product attributes and the quality of the product are probably important. You can differentiate your product from the competition. And so these are factors to be aware of if your consumers consider this to be a shopping product for them. And then specialty products. Substitutes are not accepted. If I want a really fancy sports car, you're not going to sell me on a Ford. If I want the right wedding dress, you're not going to sell me on something off the rack. Infrequently purchased, people do engage in extensive search. Brand loyalty may be strong, or we may have loyalty to retailer, as important as brand selection. And because this is so important to us, we may be willing to travel great distances to get the thing. So from a strategy viewpoint, man, we only have to be in a very few places. People are going to go find us. There's a Ford dealership in most towns, Toyota dealership in most towns, Maserati dealer. There might be two in Ohio. People who want Maseratis are willing to go travel to get their Maserati. Consumers will seek products regardless of location. There's extensive product and price differentiation available. And people have a very strong image of that brand in their mind because it's really important to them. What sort of brand are you selling? What sort of product are you selling? How do consumers picture you? It influences your whole marketing strategy. Unsought products, a category we didn't talk about. These things are things consumers don't know about or doesn't initially want. How many of us know we're going to die one day? Not all of us. And we're going to need a gravestone, you know, a plot. How many of us picked out our funeral plots? You're going to need it. Why don't you have it picked out? Life insurance. You guys have life insurance? Couple people. You're going to die. Get some life insurance. So interest is often caused by a sudden or unexpected problem. There's a death in the family, and you've got to come up with a funeral plot and all those details. Or a little less dire, but it's raining, and you don't have an umbrella. So you want it. The consumer is not very likely to be loyal, will accept substitutes in the moment, because they don't have a lot of interest in it. So as a marketing strategy, limited distribution, when people need it, they'll come find it. You do need to advertise. Consumers do need to be aware that you exist when the need arises for it. And it may require persistent and aggressive advertising and selling approach. People don't really yearn for insurance, but we see a lot of advertisements out there for insurance. Think Flo, etc. High and Lois. A little unsought product humor. Sorry, but I don't think I need any more insurance. Herb. Herb says, you have two daughters, right? I says, yes. Herb says, then you should look at our comprehensive wedding planner package insurance program. So we can think about how an actual company segments based on consumer markets, thinking about their products and how consumers think about those products. Spectrum Brands, providing quality and value to consumers worldwide. Our mission, Spectrum Brands, is a rapidly growing, global, diversified, market-driven consumer products company. We'll continue to grow our company through a combination of strategic acquisitions and organic growth. We'll strengthen our brands and generate growth through emphasis on brand strategy and marketing, innovative product technology, design, and packaging. We'll leverage IT infrastructure, distribution channels, purchasing power, and operational structure globally to continue to drive efficiencies and reduce costs. And we will profitably expand our distribution in all served markets. So what do their product lines look like? They have home and personal care products, Remington Black & Decker, George Foreman, Red Man and Juice Man. They have global pet care products, all of that long list. They have a hardware and home improvements line, you can see there, and home and garden products. And we can imagine that there would be different channels of distribution, different marketing mixes, different consumer involvement, and so different product management across these different product lines from this company. Or we can talk about classifying goods for businesses instead of for consumers. B2B goods, okay? B2B goods are products that assist, either directly or indirectly, in providing products for resale. Also called B2B goods, industrial goods, organizational goods, such as manufactured material and component parts. So your products might include things like electrical resistance screws, electric motors, computer chips, and spark plugs to businesses. Hardly any of us go out and buy a bunch of screws just to have them for our own personal pleasure. Of course, until the day I would have said not a lot of people go out and buy used chewing gum for personal, but process of raw materials used in production. They become part of a finished product, so chemicals, wood, wheat, and cotton. Installations. These are big, expensive, long decision-making products like primary production equipment, major capital items like buildings, computer hardware, assembly line, oil drilling rig. I don't know what that costs, but it's a lot of money. Somebody doesn't do that impromptu. Hey, give me that oil drilling rig, please. So this is an elaborate sales effort. Accessory equipment, copiers, office equipment, cell phones, hand tools that help the office run to make that profit for the company. MRO, you'll hear those initials periodically in the real world of business, referring to maintenance, repair, and operating supplies. These facilitate routine operations like writing paper and staples and tape and post-it notes. Probably the buying center isn't involved in this. This is probably just the purchasing agent. Go get some MRO products. Or services to businesses. These are the intangible products provided by others to facilitate the firm's production and operation. Maintenance, repairs, trucking, security services, legal advice, consulting, advertising might be a service to a B2B world. All right, so either B2B or B2C. So we're focused, as the chapter began, on the development of new products, either entirely new or a little bit new, but new. The continuous improvement of existing products. Why bother? It seems like it's a lot of fuss for new products or changing existing products. We have things that are working okay. Why bother? Let me say that in my opinion, your future job at your future company depends on your company's ability to do that, to come up with new products and new services in the long run, maybe not today. Any company that does not innovate will eventually be crushed by competition or abandoned by their consumers as they want their needs, want, and desires change, and they move on to new things. Bye, we don't need you anymore. Whoops, I should have innovated. So the quote here is, innovate or die for your future company. So it's really important to think about the development of those new products, whether it's entirely new or the continuous improvement of existing products. How does this work at a company like Google? Well, the quote from Google would be, ideas come from everyone in the company. I don't know why they pick on even the finance team. We want open information on every project, every idea, every deadline. We want people involved. They say, look, we've got to favor intelligence over just years of experience. That's not the key thing here. Employees get a free day each week to innovate. 50% of the new products come from this free day each week to innovate. They say, look, don't politic for your idea. Use data. Eliminate I like for real data on why this is good. Give people a vision. Give them rules how to get there and deadlines. Creativity loves constraints. Make it simple and easy to love. The customers, the demand, the money will follow this. So this is one way to think about innovation. On the other hand, let's think about a non-tech company. We know Whirlpool, right? Appliance manufacturer. Whirlpool says, stick with it. It can take 6 years to attain a big payback. Could you wait 6 years for a payback in the world of technology, IT, and software? Probably not. 6 months is probably a long time to wait for a new development in that field. It's already moved beyond you. Innovation alone is not enough. We need operational excellence as well. Who's bought a software product, whether it's a game or a piece of software, that occasionally glitches? Blue screen, checks out, you have to reboot. That's not great, but in software we sort of accept it. Would you accept a dishwasher that, you know, sort of when you used it periodically, you sprayed water out into the floor or leaked on? You wouldn't do that. It works. The innovation works differently in these two domains. So you need operational excellence as well. Be highly practical. Inventions have to be something someone will buy. I was never clear who was going to buy a refrigerator with a built-in television set. Did you ever see that or hear of it? Really? Really? I got a laptop that delivers TV. I got my TV over there in that room. I got a flat-screen TV on my car. I need a refrigerator with a television in it. How are you wiring that up anyhow? I guess wireless. What are you thinking? Probably not a great invention. But Whirlpool sells from new product ideas less than 5 years old were less than 30 million. Today, whenever today was, they're more than $1.2 billion. Obviously, innovation became important to this staid appliance manufacturer. Now, what do we mean when we say newness? We can think about newness in terms of existing products. So this new thing is functionally different. Changes the way we do things. Anybody know the Atari, the original Atari? Yeah? Okay. Would we say that this was probably functionally different from that? Yeah, that's new. That's a new thing. And then we can go on with the rest of it as we change the way in which the thing actually operates. Functionally new. Yay. Or we can turn to a different definition of newness. We can talk about newness in legal terms. Legally, they say, you can't call a product new for more than 6 months after it's in regular distribution. People fuss about what's regular distribution. People do get around the idea. Sometimes a product will say new, exclamation point. Sometimes they change it around. Sometimes it just says, now, exclamation point. I didn't say it was new, I just said now. So they're getting around this legal restriction of 6 months. We can look at it from the management side of the house. Managers can see new products as being new to the world, a true innovation. Any risk there with a product that's new to the world and true innovation? There might be risk. We don't know what it is, how to market it, if the consumers want it or not. There's a lot of risk involved in a true innovation. When it first came out, home computers, we just heard about a major company said there's no need for them. The internet itself was, of course, a revolution, although it caught on quickly. Sticky notes, a new-to-the-world innovation that 3M originally wanted to throw away. They didn't think it was a good idea that it would ever catch on. Obviously it did. Hard to judge how new to the world products will work. They're high risk. You're going to put a lot of money in this. You're going to develop it. You're going to stock it, manufacture it, market it. Who knows if anybody will buy it? Easier for management to think about is a product category or brand extension. We diversify into an established market for an existing product, but it's new to us. So we know there's a demand out there for some other sort of similar product. We're just going to extend our product category. We know there's a product called ice cream that people pretty much like. It's not like it's an undiscovered product. Would anybody like this thing called ice cream? And we're Oreos. What about Oreos ice cream? Doesn't seem as risky. It's new, but it's just an extension. So it's new to us, not as risky. Or just product line extensions, just changes to the baseline product itself, not risky at all. So we'll just make additions to our existing product lines. In this category, it might be different flavors. So for example, Cheerios. Anybody still like Cheerios as a cereal? Cheerios. But then we got Honey Nut Cheerios, Berry Burst Cheerios, Yogurt Burst Cheerios, Multigrain Cheerios, Cheerios Crunch, Fruity Cheerios, Frosted Cheerios, and Apple Cinnamon Cheerios. Not hugely risky to come up with a new flavor, to come up with a product line extension from a management viewpoint, yeah? Now, of course, it's probably less to gain than an entirely new product category if that product category is successful. So if we can think about new from the viewpoint of managers, we can also think about new from the consumer perspective. So at the bottom of the heap, the least bothersome for consumers, are continuous innovations. These are variations of existing products. The important thing here is there's no behavior changes, no new learning on the consumer side now. So when that new Special K raspberry cheesecake flavor rolls out, you don't look at it, shrug your shoulders, talk to your friends and say, how's this work? It works with a spoon, you put it in your mouth, it's pretty simple. So that's just continuous improvement, not a lot of hassle on the side of the consumer. Dynamically continuous innovations, well now, it's an improvement on an existing product, and you may have to engage in some new learning, may have to engage in some behavioral changes. So it could be a little trickier. Who fully understands exactly what a hybrid car is? Who doesn't exactly understand what it is and how it works? Could you figure it out? Could you figure out how to use it? Probably, but it's a little different than what I know how to use. I might take a little learning there. Okay? So there might be a little hesitancy. And then discontinuous innovations that operate entirely new functions, that offer require major behavioral changes, major education. For me, TiVo was a discontinuous innovation, especially compared to old DVRs, and they never got it right in the minds of consumers. I promise you, TiVo is the DVR you want, and they haven't been able to make that point, and it's going to go away soon, but it changed the way you recorded programs, for example. It changed, therefore, the way you didn't have to stay at home. It was easy to record your programs. And it was an education program that the brand never got out. All right, I can see I'm losing you. And it's a nice day outside. We'll see you next time. End the material for mini test, whatever what you said.